Hello, welcome to the Art Grind Podcast, coming to you from my apartment in the Upper East Side. I'm here with Tan Miang.
Yep.
Dina Brodsky.
Back for the rest of the year.
And welcome all the new listeners. Boy, we've had a real spike in subscribers. Thanks for tuning in. With that comes some positive reviews and some negative reviews.
Yes, we got our first negative review and we're super psyched about it.
Yay!
I know, because I know, and you know who did it? I did it. No one had anything negative to say about Kim. But apparently two episodes of me being honest.
Yeah, it's by Jenky. So this person didn't want to use it. Their real name.
So I would like to read it out loud, and may I start off with the fact that I've been listening to the episodes that we've recorded, and I actually agree with Jenky here. So here goes. I am really trying to enjoy Vincent's interview, but there's a female interviewer using the word like so much, like
he's
a
sexist.
Lot. Like, I'm going to turn it off because the guy is, like, using like so much also now. I think, like, everyone should, like, work on new unlike words. So, Jenky, I'm totally with you on that. I would love to stutter a little bit less and use like and less
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, actually, if you could throw some money our way, we could
we
put
could
Dina
animate.
In a class, in a speech therapy class.
That's actually
be awesome.
I wondering
for all of us
if Jenky was a high school debate coach, because in my high school debate we were charged a nickel every time we said the word like or
That's one way to do it.
Oh, I would be so poor, right? I mean, if I had to give you a cent every time I use the word like or I would be broke right now.
Well, what's that old saying? If I had a nickel for every time Dina said like, I'd be a rich man.
Hey guys, I'm a non-native speaker. That's my excuse. I have a speech impediment. Please forgive me. I will hope to entertain you enough that the likes are unimportant like.
Yeah.
We love you. We don't. I like it. I like the way it goes. It's very charming.
And I've been listening to Dina for ages, so I don't even hear the likes anymore.
You guys are just
I'm sound
used
deaf,
to me.
I'm deaf to your likes.
But it is a good point. Like, because there's so many new listeners. What do you guys want to hear? Like, we've been, you know, I've been conscious about trying to avoid too much technique. I feel like, if you want to learn what type of linseed oil Vincent uses, take a workshop. You know, this isn't really the place. We're into talking about people's lives, their struggles, what it's like to be an artist. But we're really open to hearing feedback from you guys. We may ridicule you on mic, but
even if it's negative, because when we started
especially
doing this,
negative.
Right, too much is, you know, we live in a culture where negative feedback is almost like no one is willing to do that to someone's face, right?
Uh-huh.
No one is. We were talking about that in art schools. No one is willing to offer a negative critique.
That's so true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll you know, we'll take whatever poached eggs or rotten eggs you guys are throwing at us.
What does the far right call us little snowflakes? What are we?
Snowflakes.
Snowflakes, yeah.
You're not going to melt our little snowflakes by a few negative reviews.
But tell us what you want to hear. Tell us who you want to hear.
What would your ideal, you know, podcast sound like if we were the ideal?
I want to hear more likes. I want to hear more ums. I want to hear less techniques.
More filler.
I want more tangents. I, for one.
And Marshall, you should cut Dina off every time she tries to say something.
Yeah, that's another one. I can apparently come off very hostile towards all these cutoffs.
Apparently I wasn't noticing that I wasn't noticing this.
And I'm also a minority. Marshall, you can't see this, but... So, you know.
Oh, shit.
Bring on the...
I'm the only white male in here.
Well, see, you're the minority.
Fuck.
So Marshall, so I've been out of New York all summer. This is the interview that we're doing, the intro before actually took place as Abby. What have you been up to for the last 2 months?
Oh, my God. Well, I taught all summer at the League. Great class. Super fun. And I've been getting ready for a show, and I haven't stepped foot out of New York City except for one afternoon to go to Dia Beacon last week, and that was awesome. What do you guys think of that art? Because I was with another painter friend, and it's very conceptual, very like twisted neon and videos and smashed cars, but I just love that stuff. Like, what are your guys' opinions on that? Is it art? Is it, you know?
I haven't been to the place,
I was right next door to the place with a bunch of people who were in the middle of a really intense acid trip, and I like the people who are on acid. I just felt like they would have a better trip without me.
Well, it does sound like tripping on acid is the ideal way to go to Dia.
That's correct.
And I would love to have that acid-addled review. Did they say anything about it? Like, the yes, colors.
I could, you know, when we're off air, I could send you their way, and you get the full lowdown.
We should have them on Art Grind, like a review, yes. Like one acid lover's review of. Speaking of acid trips, trippy art.
Speaking of acid trips, as a guest this week, who I was so heartbroken not to be around to interview, is Hannah Faciata. Her art, whether on acid or not on acid, is spectacular. And I believe trippy. I hope she doesn't mind me using that word to describe it.
I would call it trippy for sure. Yeah, we had a great conversation with Hannah. Actually, there were like, what, five of us in the room?
It was a packed.
And a whole ton of Pop-Tarts?
Yeah, there was a lot of Pop-Tart going on.
Dita, you missed it.
Yeah, it was a bit of a party.
I missed everything. Wait, was it actually type A fun? Because of course
it was legit type A fun.
It was definitely type A fun. And
someone threw up at the end of this podcast. We made Pop-Tarts, and who was here? Sophia was filling in for Dina.
Yep,
she did an excellent job.
Yeah.
She's really great.
It doesn't have any likes or ums.
Yeah, we'll be getting positive feedback.
You know that one interview Dina wasn't around for.
And then Jen was here, hanging out with
Hannah. Yeah, past guest, friend of the show, Jen Gennari, was here. And then us two.
Yep.
And we talked to Hannah, ironically, about being raised in faith, Hannah Faciata, and her artwork and how she sort of now lives on a bit of a art compound out in Pennsylvania. Did you know that?
No.
It's like Adam Miller and Alexandra and JP and her and I think a few others all just like are out in Pennsylvania now.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
It's the next beacon.
Yeah, it's the next Bushwick.
Or the next Bushwick.
Yeah, I love how you have to get that far out.
By the way, I'm squatting in a studio in Bushwick right now, which is really fun.
Yeah, that's what's going on with your summer.
You've been taking care of my neighbor's cat.
Yeah, so it's been interesting for me because I get a chance to go to other people's places and house sit, cat sit, dog sit.
Plants sit, my plant case. Sit. Ton did an excellent job keeping my plants alive. Then my husband came back, Ton moved out.
And I also cleaned up your place.
You cleaned up my place. The plants have unfortunately started looking a lot worse since you moved out.
Ted, yeah. You're going to know every borough of New York City better than anyone at the end of this run.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing. and I'm going to have, and I'll be visiting everybody's houses. So yeah.
Speaking of plants, Dina, check these out. These from a seed.
Seriously?
I planted seeds, and now we could take a photo for the podcast. Like, they are spectacular, and they are blooming.
I've got to say, Marshall's plants are thriving.
Thank you.
My plants right now are breaking my heart.
Bring them over. I'll inject new life into it. Apparently, I got a green thumb.
Whereas apparently I don't. I just, you know, I keep popping out kids. I mean, like, but yet I can't keep a pot of plants alive.
that should be an indicator. You should have to take care of a plant first.
Parental aptitude. Yes. Oh, I would have failed that test. For me, I think the middle ground was the city. Like, it was like, it's almost like enveloping yourself in chaos and seeing what comes out of it, you know?
Uh-huh. I think that's what that statement you just had. That should be in your fucking bio, man.
Hello. So here's what we got going on in the room right now. We have a room full of people. We have myself, Marshall Jones, Ton.
Yep.
We have Sophia, a brand new co-host, Sophia, today.
Hello.
Extra special guest, woo-hoo, Hannah Yada, here.
Yay.
And
extra special
Jin Janari sitting in laughing. So.
Yes.
And coughing.
And coughing. We have Jin and her cold here.
She knows all my dirty secrets. Mm-hmm.
Emotional support.
So, Hannah, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where do you come from?
I guess I grew up in Georgia, but...
Well, where in Georgia? Because yeah, I know Georgia.
I read that on your thing, but I was like, where in Georgia?
Really boring small town, you know.
Which one, though?
Carrollton! Yeah, you know that one.
Of course, it's close to Alabama.
Yeah.
Carrollton. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who grew up in Carrollton.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Are they fucked up? Sorry. I shouldn't say that. I'm just
There's so many different kinds.
Yes.
Which category of
he seemed fairly well adjusted, though, but he did attend a very fucked up high school with me.
my only proper
schooling experience. He was there, and it was like in this office park, and we would go to this like weird school every day. And he would go from Carrollton to there in Atlanta.
Wow.
It's like forever.
What's the biggest... Okay, when did you move to New York?
Right after I graduated.
Okay.
So in Georgia, they have like a scholarship. So basically if you have...
A Hope Scholarship?
Yep. High grades. Yes, exactly. You get to go to school for free.
Hope Scholarship ruled.
Yeah.
So you did your undergrad there.
Yep. I did my undergrad, finished, and got the heck out of there.
That's how I did it.
Where did you go to undergrad?
University of Georgia.
You know who taught there? Willem de Kooning.
What?
Really? He taught a few semesters at UGA, for sure.
No.
Greatest painter of all time. Yeah.
I don't believe it.
Yes, he did.
I love Willem de Kooning. That's amazing.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Wow.
UGA.
Georgia.
You gotta add that into your bio.
I know. Willem de Kooning.
You can say you studied with him.
Yeah.
I studied. His spirit was still in the hallway.
So you grew up in Carrollton, Georgia.
Yeah.
What is, because I heard Sophie and I both grew up religious.
Oh.
I'm a little more culty than she did, but she's certainly...
You don't know.
I don't want to know your story.
So how did you... You grew up religious, correct?
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that.
So I grew up Jehovah's Witness.
I only knew one Jehovah's Witness person growing up. And I knew that they couldn't have a birthday. They couldn't celebrate their birthday.
Very awkward going
to
school.
So how did that affect you growing up?
Yeah, so it's like you go to class and, you know, there was always saluting the flag first thing in the morning and you have to sit down. So, yeah, after we got back to school, you know, smartest kid in the class and somehow in, like, all the honors programs, which was already like, oh, you're a freak. And then you're like a Jehovah's Witness freak because then you can't, like... salute the flag or have birthdays or
so you were a little kid who just couldn't participate in the things that everyone was they were doing this thing, the saluting, and you were like,
yeah, found yourself having to explain why.
Yeah,
often
explain. And well, that was like part of the thing was that you were supposed to explain so you could like get other people to understand your beliefs. Yeah. And you can bring them to church.
Right,
and
right.
Show them the way.
Them to church.
But you were so young, did you know what was going on? Like, you knew to explain, but did you understand more about why and how this was all working the older you got?
I don't think that I thought that critically. I think I was such a people pleaser at that point that I was just happy making my parents and my friends and my family happy. But, you know, it's like...
You were not saluting the flag at school. Did you feel... Because I have a few theories that'll probably pop up later. Did you feel isolated? Did you feel like you're entertaining yourself? Did you want to engage? Did you just say, fuck it? What was your mentality?
I really wanted to engage, but, like, I think every moment that I wanted to engage, I was pulled back from it. Because, you know, you can't have...
There's something weird. Everywhere you turn, there's something.
You couldn't do school sports. You couldn't do any extracurricular activities. You couldn't hang out with anybody from the school outside of school. So, you know, because they were, like, they termed it worldly. Like, they weren't part of that religion.
We said worldly in my thing, too.
You know.
We had our own version of that as well.
You had that, too?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm half Japanese, too, and my dad would regularly send me to school with, like, dried fish or squid. Mm. And literally, the principal, when I was in, like, fourth grade, picked it up and showed it to the entire lunchroom. He's like, what the fuck is this?
Oh, shit. That's terrible.
Look at this fish. Funny food. This weirdo.
It's very alienated.
It's not a burger.
She's not even American. She don't like the flag.
Oh my God. I'm serious, though. Like, I was the only kid there. And then it was, like, the squid and the food shit. You know, like, I just sat there, like, watching my elbows the entire lunchtime.
Aww. If I was there, I would have been your buddy, though. Aww. We would have been, yeah.
Yeah, we would have been cool.
Okay, so you're growing up, you're getting older, you're still in the faith. What happens? When did you realize, like, I don't know if I would,
I don't think there was ever, like, a moment where I was like, oh, this belief system doesn't work. But I think, like, my dad and my mom, my mom decided to leave my dad.
Whoa. And, so, but your dad was Japanese.
Yeah.
And your mom seems white to me.
Yeah.
Was she the more religious one?
Yeah, she's always been the super religious one.
But she chose to leave your dad.
Yeah, but he was very religious growing up. And then suddenly when I was 14, he started kind of putting a lot of things, like, doubts about it, and she freaked out and decided to, like, just leave him one day.
That's when she left him. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
Because he was like, okay.
And then I think unconsciously, you know, I just started deciding to rebel and started dating a guy in high school. And
dating, my God.
I know. That age.
That's very bad. We're going to have to ask you to leave.
Man. Yeah.
Scary things happen when you start to date in a religious household.
We don't date here, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, and then we already have a bit of a spoiler in your narrative. We know you ended up at UGA.
Yeah.
So there's a gap from there. How does that happen? Because I would imagine...
And you're studying...
Yeah, what are you studying?
Oh, at that point I was studying art because the first 2 years of... school, actually Georgia State.
Oh, sure. Georgia State rules.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I had no idea. I thought I was going to be like I was going to major in psychology or something more practical.
So you're driving from Carrollton to Atlanta to go to Georgia State?
No. So Carrollton is like just like basically until I was maybe 12. And then we moved to Tennessee.
Okay.
And then I did a lot of moving around, and I don't know if you want to hear the whole crap. But
let's hear the crap. I love it.
So I guess Tennessee is where I went off the rails and decided to, like, rebel.
It's a good place for going off the rails.
Yeah. What? Yeah.
So what does that rebelling entail?
Boyfriend.
Yeah, boyfriend. Dad. Like, I think at some point I'm my mom was like, that, just get married. You know, I want you out of my house. I think I was going to do it, but then she, like, decided that she put me in a treatment camp. I was always sneaking out at night. So I was coming back at
you were sneaking out at night.
I don't think I was sleeping the whole 2 years I was rebelling in high school.
I'm so disappointed in you.
So I'm like sneaking back at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my God.
I'm high as hell.
That's the witching hour. And you were high?
Yes.
I'm not going to listen to this.
I'm in my room, and then suddenly two huge female bounty hunters like
what?
Come and bounty snatch hunter. Me up.
Like Boba Fett?
Well, no, they weren't like that, but, you know, they're just
Hannah,
like,
no.
We're taking your daughter, and we're taking... Anyway.
These were from agents the Jehovah's of the treatment witness? Camp.
Yes. Were they from the Jehovah's Witness?
God.
No.
This was something else.
This was like...
This was a medical thing.
I guess my mother hired them to take me to this treatment camp.
Was the
treatment camp religious,
sketchy.
Or was it medical?
Just medical. Oh. Well, mostly medical. Probably not something too far-fetched from, like, 12 steps or something.
because you were high and coming in late. And
but she was like really worried. And should she have been looking back? Should she have been really worried, or was she just like overreacting?
Well, that's the thing. If she had communicated with me, I don't think she had anything to be worried about.
Right.
But because she had basically frozen me out and said it's either like getting married to your abusive boyfriend or like turning back into a Jehovah's Witness, like those are my two choices. Oh, like part of me is like, I might just jump off the roof at some point, you know. You know, like what, how many choices do you have, you know? And I was kind of alienated from my father at this point, so that wasn't really an option.
Where was he?
Did you speak with him?
No. Yeah, yeah. No, he actually like reconnected with me at the camp, which was like the best thing that happened from that experience.
At the treatment camp?
Yeah. He was like, your mother's crazy. Come live with me.
he seems like he makes a good point.
Yeah. And I was like, please get me out of here. I will do anything.
So what was this? Was this like, you know, white robes and stuff like this at this treatment camp or bunk beds or what was it?
Yeah. So it was, I guess it's a sort of an unorthodox sort of thing. So it was like an outside place. So you live in this dinky log cabin. You basically just walk around in sweatpants, okay. But at night, you know, they take all your clothes, well, most of your clothes, so you can't run away. It's all, like, super outdoorsy stuff, so...
Oh, you're, like, hiking and stuff in the day.
Yeah, like, you're hiking, making your own dinner over a, like, fire stove and, you know...
But it probably added to your anger.
Yes. I mean, well, the biggest thing that added to my anger was just, like... You know, it was one of those things where, like, you can't just talk, you know, between yourselves. Like, you'd always have to have three people.
Oh.
You know, and then you would also have to, you were required to speak a certain amount of times per day about, like, your feelings. And it was a certain topic that you had to process every week. And that sort of stuff is
religious? Just, was it religious?
No, it was just
prescriptive.
Yeah, it was very scriptive. It was just... You know, it was so forced, I guess. Uh-huh. You know, like,
yeah. So do you feel like this, I don't know, changed your worldview or your view of yourself, the fact that you went through this at all?
I was terror. I think it instilled a sense of terror from you because you can't talk to your friends. You can't talk to your family for a certain amount of time unless you're on super good behavior and do everything they tell you to. And... You know, it basically, like, isolates you from even really making real friends because you can't speak honestly to people. Like, I think the thing there that really bothered me the most was that everybody had a mask on because they just wanted the fuck out of there.
You know? Like, kind of saying whatever it takes to get a passing grade in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was just so miserable.
So then,
yeah, it's time
then
to showers is time.
Your dad comes in, and he's like, this place is nuts. We're getting you out of here, essentially.
He makes you leave earlier than you're supposed to.
He didn't make it. No, my mom...
He facilitated it?
No, I don't think he tried legally, but I don't... ultimately, my mom basically ran out of money and was like, you know, 6 months, okay, you seem good enough, come live with me. And then I got all my shit and left.
Okay.
And then where to from there?
So after, like, I was just like, you know, I'm going to go live with my dad. Okay. I went down to Atlanta and lived with him.
In the city of Atlanta?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Norcross.
Did you feel close with him when you moved in with him? Or did you become closer with him over time?
He's a hard person to be close to. He's always working, but we tried. I think he always meant best, but he's very Japanese in the way that it's all about education and, you know, not really, like, talking that much.
You had your own car or not?
I did at that point.
You did?
Yeah.
So you were pretty free. This is, like, 16?
This is probably, like, 17, 18.
It's a dad, like, working a lot, you living with him.
Yeah.
Driving to your shit, whatever that is.
High school.
So then that was a period. Then you went to apply to UGA for an art program.
No, I was at a point where I'm just like, I want to be free.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, after, like, I graduated, I thought, you know, I was going to, you know, chill for a year, figure things out, work. And he submitted an application to University of... Oh, Georgia State University. Sorry.
Yep. Uh-huh.
And he's like, yes. He's like, you're going to college.
They were Eagles or something at Georgia State? What was their thing?
Panthers?
Oh, was it a Panther?
I don't know.
Yeah, let's take a break. Let's all pee. We all got to go together. Let's wake up. Everybody wake up.
Down.
Time to pee.
Put the clothes back on or off, whatever.
I've actually been to Israel, and I've been to the place where all of the, I don't know, the end of the world is supposed to happen, where God comes and he takes everyone's souls up and people are judged for the second time.
Yeah.
I've been to that actual place, and everyone wants to be buried there. So there's just like a million little tiny headstones.
That's amazing.
Like smushed into a valley.
Is it kind of like Queens?
they're all
exactly
really good,
like,
except for they're all worried about the second coming.
Yeah, no. When I first saw Queens, I was just like, "Holy shit!" But I mean, I guess this would probably be a much grander scale. And
it was intense. But I mean, the reason we're interested in your upbringing and your faith and your relationship with your family and like all of these things, they form your identity. They form my identity.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, they can't help but affect your paintings.
Yeah.
They can't help it. And so that's why, I don't know, I guess I want to know more about how that is related to the paintings that you make. Because, I mean, I was reading your bio.
Terrible. Don't read that.
Speak about that. You say it's terrible?
Yeah,
it's terrible. It's not terrible. There's a lot of words that are really interesting. There's some words that kind of pop out to me are the unconscious mind, the natural environment, emotion, in touch with the earth, celebrating energy and wildness, and then the sentence that really I think captures, you know, what I was feeling and looking at when I looked at your work was the surreal and psychedelic landscapes of your work erupt with tension and beauty. The grotesque and the wild form exhilarating and mind-altering dreamscapes. That's like, for me, like, you really, like, it's like a swoosh in the basket. You know, I don't know if you ever play basketball, but
no,
that sounds so good.
You weren't allowed to.
I don't know. I feel like that is very related to all the stuff that you've been saying to us about your upbringing. I want you to, I don't know, play in that place with us.
Play.
How is that statement related to all of these things?
That's the place that I wasn't allowed to go, I think, growing up, you know?
What do you mean? Elaborate on that.
Well, I mean, like, you know, our life was so, like, our parents and everybody around us were always looking at everything. Like, my dad, I still love him, but he put, like, spyware on our computers growing up. So he knew exactly where we were going, no matter what we did on the computers. Anytime we went out, even when I was a teenager, there were always, you know, it was a small town growing. Well, especially when we lived in Tennessee, so that if you were up to no good, somebody was always telling on you. Like, I remember this.
Oh, really?
Was one girl who worked.
That's the culture, right, of Jehovah's Witnesses. You have to help keep everyone in line, right?
But this girl was, like, she was, like, 17, and she worked at McDonald's, and she was smoking. And they disfellowshipped her for smoking. And I remember that day, like, it was, like, a day ago, you know? Like,
disfellowship, that means she's out of the church?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Like her friends, her family, everybody.
You can't even speak to her.
Yes. She's a ghost.
She can't go to heaven.
It's almost like if you decided to say, you're dead, you know, and like people will ignore you like you're dead.
You have to.
Yeah.
Because you can't, if you don't ignore, then you might not go to
heaven. If you don't ignore, you're not helping them realize their wrongs.
Or you don't love God by, you know, if you talk to him, you don't love God, you know.
So that was a huge moment for you. That kind of made in your head like a, I mean, I'm imagining. If someone said, made that kind of scenario happen in my life, that happens in my life, that would kind of make me compartmentalize where I was allowed to be, my own person with my own independence. I'm not allowed to A, B, and C.
Yeah.
Or else.
Yeah.
This will happen to you. Look what has happened to your friend that was smoking, blah, blah, blah. Like what a tangible example.
Yeah.
Do you feel like maybe the spaces that you're painting in your work right now are related to kind of creating a spiritual internal space where you're allowed to do whatever the fuck you want?
Yeah.
Tell us more about this. I feel like it's really important that you verbalize this.
Well, I think for me, you know, one of the like most dirty things growing up was the female body. You know, it was like, you know, like females were like the lowest of the low in the church, you know, like you had to cover your head if there wasn't a male in the room and say a prayer if, you know, like to kind of lead the whole meeting if, you know, there wasn't a male around. But anyway, like basically you really had no say as a female. They were just like,
you'll make babies one day.
Exactly. Like, you'll make Jehovah's Witness babies. And, you know, like, maybe you'll marry a good man that becomes, like, great, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Leader.
So female bodies, to me, are, like, one of the, I guess, biggest rebellions, you could say, is, like, this sort of voluptuous form that just, you know, supposedly is this, like, evil temptress, especially from, like, biblical origins. And
I'm immediately imagining your women with the giant fish heads on them, like those grotesque fish heads.
Yeah.
That's immediately coming to mind while you're describing this.
Yeah, they're beautiful but grotesque, and they have these like weird masky types of faces that, you know, for me it's like, I remember when I first started painting them, and then I had these interviews and people would ask me if I believed in the divine feminine. And I guess, you know, at that time, I had no idea really what they were talking about.
What the hell does that even mean?
Yeah.
That sounds like the Madonna whore complex to me.
Not exactly. Like, it's like, I think it goes back to this, like, whole idea of, like, the goddess religion and all this stuff. But I didn't really know about that at that time. Mm-hmm. And so, for me, like, you know, when I was painting, like, these fish women, they were, like, terrifying but erotic but
powerful.
You know, yeah, like they were powerful, but they had like these faces that were sort of mask-like and just like staring at you and just
mask for like an identity, like identityless, or
they're kind of blank, those fish heads.
Exactly, in a way, like think of those Vogue commercials where you just have like the woman with her like gaping mouth and like open eyes that are just like sort of blankly staring at you, you know?
I see that shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like that.
So I came into it with like, you know, like a very feminist vibe swinging, and I was just like, I'm bringing this like mask in, and it's weird and it's grotesque and it's,
you know. But as a rebellion.
Yeah. Well, uncomfortable.
So were you what thinking about the irony of it? The irony of that kind of
exactly
face.
Yeah.
And the nude has somehow definitely become another, there's like a new conservatism in art right now that, like, what would you think if a man was painting your images? What would you give that free license, or would you say that's sexist, or...
I don't know. I don't really like to judge other people because I don't know like what his background would be.
But in the art world, it's all about judging some, hoping someone's doing wrong so you can judge it. It seems like, right? Isn't that the art world we so live pathetic. In? Just like looking at imagery and being like, well, this probably isn't fully correct in this way. Let me talk about how it's not. It feels like That's the world we're in, which is very religious in nature. You know, it's like, I think that the two cults I've been in are definitely an art cult and religious cult.
It's true. Looking
to slam someone for not being appropriate enough.
Yeah.
He's trying to build a new one.
Right. Yeah, I'll be the leader.
It's all about political correctness now, isn't it?
But yeah, it is all about political correctness for sure. And I can't help see your work out of that scope in light of, boy, like, I certainly wouldn't be a man painting that sort of imagery, you know?
It's really hard to say. Like, I don't know. I can't really imagine a guy painting it. Unless he was like, oh, let's sexualize this really creepy or something. But
do you think there's room for a man to paint kind of problems of sexual identity, even a straight white man, in those ways that just confusion? Is there room for that guy to paint confusion?
Sure.
Or should we just... Okay.
Yeah. Well, sorry.
I think so.
Yeah. I mean,
It's hard. I mean, it's certainly... You guys are an exception, I would say, to that conversation, for sure.
I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but, you know, it's like when I watch, like, a couple of documentaries about, like, men and like, this attraction to, like, the new sort of women dolls that are robots and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
I can understand the confusion and the frustration and, like... The wanting to connect with somebody and just, like, I don't know. It's almost like the mind fuck of industrial society in a way. Like, I don't say that I don't understand it, you know, because I see it, you know? Like, I could see a guy painting what I paint, I guess.
Your work seems to be almost the mind fuck of an organic society, right? Like how hard it is to be on this planet with all this... organic material around you.
I really
okay, I was talking to Marshall about this, and we were looking at, you know, your references of nature. You're constantly using animals and plants and landscape to kind of help us see or frame what you're thinking about, this other world. I was noticing that I was kind of trying to see the relationship between someone that's painting nature and talking about nature. I don't know if you know Angela Graham, but she paints nature and it's about the absence of nature in society. But when you use nature, it's a metaphor for something else. You're not trying to paint it anatomically correct. You're painting out how it feels. It's a prop in a stage set. It's part of a fantasy.
I think some of them are and some of them aren't. And I guess that's my problem with having like a sliding scale of subject matter in a way. Because some of them are kind of like this sort of resistance against industrialism or like kind of fighting to live in it. And then other ones are sort of this, I like to think of it as... like nature enveloping or having this celebration in it.
Yeah. As a protector? Like
a protector or like this thing that just like something that you can't stop.
Like overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Just nature's over.
Completely overwhelmed.
Yeah. Do you find spirituality in nature? Is it a replacement for kind of the spirituality of your youth?
I think it's becoming that. For me, I think the middle ground was the city. Like, it was like, it's almost like enveloping yourself in chaos and seeing what comes out of it, you know? Like, it was just...
The city as chaos.
Yes.
I think that's what that statement you just had, that should be in your fucking bio, man. No, seriously. I know it sounds poetic and artsy, but, like, that's some truth you're speaking there. Enveloping yourself in chaos and seeing what comes out of it?
It's like you're painting with the birds. All the birds.
That's where you are.
birds. What? No, because you did that painting with all those birds. There was like, that's chaos.
Yeah.
And they were all, and it was a beautiful painting, but they were all eating each other.
Yeah.
But did you ever hear Herzog talk about nature being chaos on YouTube? Did you ever see any of those?
I'm not sure if I have.
You would love those videos because you do YouTube and I don't even do it. He talks about nature as chaos and the birds chirping is just asphyxiation and horror, you know? God. And like he's like, look at the stars. He has that terrible German. He's amazing, but he has this German accent. He's like, look at the stars. They are a mess. There is no order. And I hear him, and I'm like, oh my God, I so agree with that. And he's like all about the absurdity in nature itself, like how you're just sort of in this planet that is impossible to figure out. You don't know what's going to happen when you leave this planet. You don't know how you got here. Or it's the terror, you know, which may have beauty on the other side for sure. But I like someone like Herzog who's like, it's horrible out here. Like, even with like...
Marshall loves that theory.
No, but seriously, do you share that? Do you feel like it's fucking horrible and terrifying and chaotic?
I love it. Well, yes. I've definitely been trying to come to terms with the whole idea of the terror, you know, dying tomorrow, getting eaten by a bear, especially when we live. You don't know
what's going to happen.
You know, yeah, maybe somebody decides to shoot you out in the woods. Who knows? You know, like anything. You eat the wrong fucking mushroom. You're dead.
Oh my God. We have to ingest food into our system all the time. And that is a dangerous proposition. Taking anything into our bodies. The absurdity of that is mind-blowing.
No, yeah, just stop eating.
It could be undercooked. You could be allergic to it. I don't like that.
Just stop reading. Just die.
You want to read it? Jen wants to read
something. What are you going
to
read? Jen, take the mic. Jen, read something. They can't hear you over there. You keep talking, but no one can hear. This is Jen.
What is this one called?
It's the Donner Party.
The what?
Donner Party.
Donner Party? Yeah. Donner Party.
The people that died in Oregon?
Uh-huh, that is the Donner Party.
So it's a painting that's beautiful. There's a bunch of flowers, beautiful composition, bunch of birds. But they're killing themselves, yeah?
They're eating each other.
They're eating each other. And she has a quote like on Instagram that says, about this painting, it says, he reminded us that a society that no longer recognizes that nature and human life have a sacred dimension, an intrinsic world beyond monetary value, ultimately commits collective suicide. Just such societies cannibalize themselves until they die.
Oh, she got you.
But is there intrinsic value to human life? Could it possibly matter when all evidence says no? It's fleeting. It leaves like this, and what you do couldn't possibly matter. We didn't hear it.
I mean, in a way, if you think that way, then nothing matters. You know, no life matters. But... You know, I think we as humans have a unique ability to
convince ourselves.
Convince ourselves that we have to the right of life above everything else. You know, like I think,
but that feels more like putting a flag on a moon than anything inherent or based in reality. It feels like we're convincing ourselves of that because life's too hard without it. And I guess the goal is to make joy. Or you could be in a third world
country, you know, living in a hut, dying of diarrhea. You're basically saying it's
worse.
It's true. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the thing my dad always said when we didn't need enough of our food. Like, thinking about all the kids in Nigeria. Yeah.
My parents used to say Ethiopia.
Exactly.
Like, finish that food.
Yeah.
My parents would say, go feed yourself. There's no food. I don't care what you're doing. Try to find some.
Like, find a Snickers bar.
You don't know how true that is.
Don't you think it's all, you know, it's all contextual? Like, if you just focus on the bad, like, obviously, like, everything looks like it's bad.
No, I think life is extremely hard for every life form on this planet. And you gotta try to make something worth it. And that's hard. Yeah. And a lot of that is philosophy and illusion to do it.
Well, we're very emotionally complex. And I feel like those strings are being continually pulled every which way, you know, especially to make us feel like we're inferior or in fear. and, you know, that definitely makes life hard, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
What is your... this is a two-part question. One would be your art making, and one would be just in your everyday life. Like, what gives you fear? In front, in the studio, and then in your everyday life.
Oh, like, physically in front of the canvas?
Like, when you go into the studio, what are you in fear of?
Just not being able to make the next painting in general, you know? Like I've taught myself a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, somehow suddenly losing that, or...
Losing the skill or the drive?
No, not specifically the drive, but probably the skill, or even, like, hey, you get hit by a bus tomorrow, and maybe your arm doesn't work, or
mm-hmm.
you can't move from your neck down, you know? Or mm-hmm. maybe you're just dead, you know?
You're really dumb.
So there's an urgency and a feeling of presence.
Yeah, it's kind of an anxiety, and I don't know if it's healthy or not, but...
Does it keep you going? Do you find motivation in anxiety?
Yeah.
Me too, for sure.
Yeah. Aren't, like,
I wouldn't do anything if I wasn't anxious all the time. Yeah. I'd never do anything.
Yes, ton.
It's like a little...
The answer's yes.
Devil on your back. It's like...
Uh-huh. It is a
devil. Pricking your, like, hindbrain.
But he doesn't even have a cogent voice, that devil. It's not like, if you don't work, you're not going to do this or not. He has no goals. It's just like, you better do something. Better do something. What are you on the couch for?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Or you're going to be going back to that grocery job and working for $7 an hour.
Mine's not near that salient. Mine's just like panic constantly, whatever it is.
It's true.
What was your education, though? Because we didn't even get into that. So you were at UGA, and you study painting. You study painting at Georgia State. And then how did you learn to paint?
It was a very, you know, it was a pretty relaxed painting program. So for me, you know, it was just kind of practice. Maybe they have, like, some modeling classes, and you try and learn as much as you can. But it wasn't very intensive at all.
Was it theoretical at all? Like, conceptual?
Not so much.
Just sort of, just a bunch of teenagers in a room, just like, oh, they got pain.
You guys are just listening to whatever the teacher fucking says.
Yeah, I mean, like, it wasn't that I had bad teachers. I just think that everybody was off in their own corner. And a lot of times it's like when we have critiques, nobody really knows what to say because everybody's so different.
You know? Everybody's still kind of establishing what art means to them.
Yeah.
They don't know how to look for a certain thing yet.
But like, if you go to New York Academy, they're going to be like, oh, you know, you didn't paint that brick right, at least, you know?
Mm.
Like, maybe you could have layered this more. But, like, where I went to school, it was kind of more like, so, what's going on here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Moving from Georgia, you have this undergrad. Now you have an understanding of art making. Understanding of a tiny Picano. Understanding of where you are in the art world. You feel good making stuff.
Yeah.
And then you come here.
Well, but that's an assumption. Did you feel good making stuff? Was it interesting to you? Did you care?
Oh, I loved it.
You loved it.
You know, like, I don't think
you'd have to if you moved here.
No, but I didn't think that I was the greatest artist in the world. I knew that I had a lot to learn, and that's why I moved here.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was just like, I'm going to get a full-time job, and I'm going to work my ass off, and I'm just going to paint in my free time until my eyes bleed and try and teach myself whatever else, you know?
Uh-huh.
So, that's what I did.
Just sort of like hanging out with friends, doing that sort of thing, picking up whatever you could along the way.
Not so much. Like, I would visit my friend's studios, but it was more like I'd come home and I would just work on a painting that I was interested in until I felt like I couldn't work on it anymore, and then move on to the next thing. And I know that it wasn't painted perfectly, but...
What would that possibly even mean? I mean, nothing's been painted perfectly.
Well, I know, like, for instance, I know my imperfections, like... I learned so much from seeing, like, the first thing that I painted that I would try over and over and over and, you know, like, the next ones to kind of correct that mistake, that eventually I'd get a little better and a little better and a little better. And I'm still not great, but, you know, like, I'm learning as I go, you know? Like, I don't think I'm a traditional painter by any means, but I guess I'm just like trying to figure out how to put what's in my head on the canvas as best I can.
So that's your standard if it, because like when Vincent was on this show, he was talking about that idea of when is a painting finished, like you said. They're finished, and it's interesting to me because I never tell anyone, students included, when a painting is done, because I hate when when someone walks in and is like, don't do another stroke, it's done.
Yeah.
And he was saying, like, art only exists to educate the artist. Like, it's like, so if you want to murder it to death and you're still learning, that painting isn't done until you've said that, you know? So I think in a lot of ways, like, that journey is so interesting about when is it done? When do you say it's done? It's done whenever you've gotten all the information out of it, and then you can put it up and then move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
It's not an aesthetic choice. It's not a market choice. It's just, I'm done. I learned everything I could.
Yeah. It's like you kind of get to this point where you're just like, I know I'm going to ruin it if I keep working on it at this point.
Right. Like, and that's something that takes a lot of discernment and sensitivity to kind of realize. I mean, in terms of my practice, there's so many different times where you're finishing a painting where you could say, it's done.
Uh-huh.
And then you choose to keep going.
Yeah.
But that's a real bravery, I think. I mean, I remember Grimaldi talking about how he doesn't like Sargent because he would paint and it would feel done and almost easy, like he didn't murder his paintings enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a real, that was an interesting insight to me as a student to be like, wow, like he didn't challenge himself to break those things enough and make them ugly, you know? Mm-hmm. It was just like, oh, it's done, you know?
Mm. Yeah, Desiderio says you should end a painting like, no, Henry, who? Did we already quote
Robert
him?
Robert Henry?
Robert Henry.
Uh-huh.
You should end the painting spirit. Like a man going over the top of the hill whistling. Not out of breath.
Well, you have to explain that.
What?
What do you
like,
mean?
Like, exactly what you said. Like, you want to go over the top of the hill with air to breathe. You don't want to be... You don't want to be, like, totally dead, because then you probably have overworked your painting.
Yeah.
Like, you want to feel like, whoa, it's fucking done.
Well, uh-huh. The thing
is, done!
It's, like, it's like you don't want to deter yourself from making the next piece, because I think it's like... I've known so many artists that are like, it's got to be perfect. So they overkill it until, you know, to the point where it's a beautiful painting, but they never want to start anything again.
Right.
You know, it's just too much of a hill to climb. Mm. So it's like, you learn what you can from this painting, and then you work another one, and you work another one.
But I think you want to work it, in my opinion, till there's a lot of awkwardness in it. Till it's no longer just a beautiful statement. Till it's gone past that.
Mm.
Till there's sweat on it.
Yeah.
Till there's fear on it. Till there's like a lot that gets in the paint that shouldn't be there with just a beautiful aesthetic.
No, I think so. I mean, I think I push myself more these days that way. But uh-huh. I think before... You know, I would swing between like the sweat and maybe stopping a little bit too early. You know, I learned a lot from either or, but those were, I experimented a lot, you know, when I moved here and just kind of did whatever, you know. It was just, for me, they were like, they were mindscapes. Like,
mindscapes.
Yeah.
Like, speak to that. I love saying that. That's the most pretentious thing to say. Speak to that.
Yeah. Like, basically, it was like me trying to digest visually, like, what I was processing, maybe consciously or unconsciously at the time. Because a lot of this time when I was, like, working, especially, you know, 40 hours a week and not sleeping, I was delirious, mm-hmm. you know, and I was just...
But you loved it.
Oh, my God. I mean, yes and no, but it was painful, like, especially when you have to bike 7 hours home and dodge cars.
What?
that?
Yeah.
What do you mean bike 7 hours?
Not 7 hours. 7 miles.
Oh, seven, 7 miles.
7 hours. That would be insane. I would be
this
like.
This part of it does seem unnecessary. Yeah. You're circling a lot of blocks.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So 7 miles home. But it was just like, you know, like I was operating on like super little sleep. And
well, Hemingway would always talk about that's the only time you can ever get anywhere in your life. I mean, he committed suicide, clearly. But it was that. And I think there's something really true almost to that point of things being too easy. It's like you got to get to points of exhaustion in your life multiple times to be anything where you're not thinking clearly, where you're making mistakes, where you run into that car to get.
Just as a side note, we're not suggesting anybody out there do this. Do not follow Hemingway's path. He pretty much went out as a way to, like, you know, get in front of a bullet. Like, he went to the front lines because he kind of loved that adrenaline rush to do his work. But, no, we do not recommend that.
I recommend it.
Marshall recommends it.
I think all of us do that in our own way every day. I mean, like, Jen knows Dan. Like, Dan lives a very safe life where my brother, where it's very beautiful and nice. But it's like he always wonders why I do what I do. And it's like, this is the dumbest shit I've ever heard. If you actually talk to him, like being an artist in New York City, you know? Yeah. And I'm always like, yeah, it's completely idiotic that I do this. And that is Hemingway, like running with the bulls. It's like, it makes no sense. There's no reason to do it. It's self-indulgent, just like some, you know, X Games.
But you need to do it.
But it's not going to end well for us in here. Like, it's the end is sort of, you know, abject poverty or hustling your whole life for things that what does it matter, you know?
It's true.
It's very Hemingway. And I think, you know, this podcast is interesting that we delve into those things. And it's truly a ballsy, like, existence day in and day out.
But at the very least, like, if you're making your own art on your own terms, then you're digging up your own crap and trying to figure out the material of your existence. I mean,
like an archaeologist of your own past?
In a way. Like, or at least, like, of your own past or of even, like, even just history in general. Like, I think when you're just working a mindless job and you're part of a factory or a company, you're not really learning anything, you know? Like, you're just kind of digesting whatever they give you.
Yeah.
You know, you're an automaton for that robot. Right.
But there are certainly automatons. That is another soapbox of mine, because there are certainly automatons in the art world that are essentially that clocking in, clocking out, painting the same fruit on the same table, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like if you're not an archaeologist digging up stuff, like, I mean, in a lot of ways, this gets really political, but like, we're all artists, all five of us or whoever in this room. How many are there here? Five.
Ten people.
All five of us are artists right now in this moment because life has gotten easier. Because we're post-industrial revolution, there's someone making our clothes at Target and our cell phone, and there's a lot of dark shit behind that, you know? Yeah. Someone's being exploited to make my life really easy, therefore I get to call myself an artist because it's fucking easy in New York City. And then
that's a spin.
You don't think so, though? I mean, like, think about it.
Shout out to all those little Asian kids.
I can sell a few paintings and teach a few days a week and call myself an artist because my clothing is really cheap and my food is. And if you're just using that privilege to paint the same fruit every day without trying to enlighten people, like your paintings do, Hannah, like trying to delve for something spiritual and something unique, it's a gross misuse of your privilege.
I think, okay, so you can have the sort of factory paintings, and I don't know, when I went to school, my colleagues would say, oh, don't do Kincaid paintings, which is like the paintings that they sell at the mall that actually
he We're
actually
fascinated with Kincaid on this podcast. We talk about him all the time.
So he actually had like what? He actually had people that painted his paintings.
But he's the greatest painting of our life, greatest painter of our lifetime. He's the most successful. By any rubric, he is the most
successful. So is Jeff Koons. And he has
Kincaid's much more successful than Jeff Koons. Everybody knows who Kincaid is, and 5% of the population know who Jeff Koons is. And he made a lot more money. There's a suburb in California designed after Kincaid's houses. There's no balloon animal suburbs out there.
I don't know. Either way, I feel like they're both kind of...
They're horrible.
Chomping off the same apple. Like, how can I get the most money and...
For sure,
exploit the most people.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But Kincaid's much more interesting than Koons as far as, like, an art project, I think. Anyway, go ahead. We derailed what you were saying.
I don't even know what I was saying anymore.
I think it was about authenticity. What does it take to be an authentic artist? What does it matter?
That's a hard conversation. I mean, moment that you think that you're an authentic artist, you're kind of still kind of becoming somebody else's idea of an authentic artist. But
that's a good line.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Uh-huh. That's a good line.
As soon as somebody can pinpoint you, you're already stuck. So you got to keep moving is what you're kind of saying, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because everybody already has these ideas of like, you know, Andy Warhol or, you know, like all these guys that like party and become like these free spirits. But I think you just have to keep searching for yourself. Like there's no real answer to anything.
Right.
It's all conjecture.
Yeah, decides what's actually authentic? Right?
Yeah.
Like that term, like. What points do you have to hit to be authentic? Like, do you have to be suffering? Do you have to, like,
do you have to dress a certain way?
Right, do you have to dress all black and, you know, write bad poetry before you, you know, like, what the hell do you do? Like, what's authentic?
Jim just pointed to me. Very rude.
Yeah, by the way, okay, I'm just going to break down what everybody's wearing right now. So Marshall has a Danzig t-shirt?
Yeah.
Black jeans, black socks, black sneakers.
By the way,
Sophia has black sunglasses, black jacket, black t-shirt, black pants, Doc Martens. I have a black shirt. I have white shoes, so I'm off the hook. I'm not authentic by any means.
You know, I just want to point out that monks and nuns wear all black.
Uh-huh.
Because they are authentic.
And I just want to say that there is an aesthetic relationship with wearing black.
I thought it was just like...
How serious it's your life is.
Well, there's a reason why people would wear black doing what I do. Traditional stuff.
Death? What do you mean?
Like what Johnny Cash says?
It serves a purpose. You'd wear black because it's the thing that won't reflect on your canvas.
Ah, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Well, I never heard that, but that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I started wearing
black.
So
it was like a legitimate uniform. It was like if you were going out painting in the studio plein air, you'd wear black because you wouldn't be affecting
the
your
image.
Mm-hmm.
I started wearing black when my grandparents died. I lost 4 grandparents consecutively.
Oh.
And in the Orthodox Church, you wear black for 40 days.
Oh.
Wow.
When somebody in your family dies. And so I was wearing black for almost a whole year. And all of my clothes got thrown out. I just didn't wear them anymore.
Clothes.
I just got used to it and I never stopped.
What is the reason to make art? In a world where a ton of it's already been made, why do it?
Why?
It's almost like the reason to live. Like right now, it's like you look out your window. And it's a beautiful scene, don't get me wrong. But imagine, like, if those were designed more like temples, for instance, and you had more Baroque sculpture around, and you had figures coming out of the post, and you had, you know, like, it's almost like it brings some sort of the mystical and the spiritual without having to be dogmatic about it. And maybe that's just like my way of like seeing the world. So much. You know, like you just like you get this sense of like wonder, you know, the sublime. But
so it does seem like art for you is trying to touch that spiritual undefined thing. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I wanted to like I'm trying to find something that kind of reflects this idea of something terrifying, which is life, you know, like you love life, but you're also terrified of it. You're terrified that you're going to lose it.
Do you think that's all that is important? I mean, I remember when I was a kid and you would have been raised in an idea of heaven and hell. You would have as well. And I remember, and a few of my friends have this same experience where you would be haunted by the idea of an afterlife. Whether it was heaven or hell was equally terrifying. You didn't want to go to a place where nothing mattered anymore, where it was done. Where, like you said, it's terrifying and beautiful at the same time. A place that's just beautiful, heaven, was as horrifying as hell that's just terrifying. Because there was no place for real, like maybe what you call art or the sublime in between.
But I guess that's where like nature comes into my work, because the comfort in the nature is the idea of regeneration. And I don't like I personally don't believe in like hell or no afterlife or like complete death at all. I just think that as things die, they regenerate into a different form. And I think somehow, you know, that memory might be broken up, but it's still there. Uh-huh. You know? Uh-huh. But I just don't think in absolute nothingness, you know, like the complete blackest of black. I still think that there's...
Not nihilist.
Yeah, like I don't think that there's nothing after death.
I would like that. I would love nothing after
death. Because like they also talk about, you know, like this idea of like transgenerational memory, you know, maybe not specifically term that, but it's like this idea that like memory is carried on through... genetics or cells or
like inherited trauma.
Well, that would be one sins of the father in the religious terms. A thing,
PTSD that's passed on through genetics.
Yeah, so I mean, like, you know, maybe you're not specifically born from somebody, but maybe, you know, if you don't have children, or you might pass that on to plants or animals or whatever, like the soil is kind of broken down into and
passed on. Is that what your art is, almost in those denial of death terms, like something to pass on? Like,
I don't really know how to say it, but I just think of nature as a regeneration of it. So for me, embracing the natural aspect of it is comforting, you know, because with our industrial society, it's like we make steel and we make plastic, and that takes like years or maybe even like a few hundred years to break down. And it's kind of, that's death, you know? It's like, how long is that actually going to stay around before it actually turns into something real again? It's like dead matter for a very long time.
Do you see your artwork as real?
That's what I feel like I'm reaching for, is some sort of mystical feeling of something that I'm searching for. Like I don't ascribe to like any sort of religion or God or anything of that sort, but I'm trying to grapple with the physicality of being, I feel. I mean, does that make sense?
Yes, okay. Yes. I think that defines what your work is about so well. That should go in your bio. that's fucking fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
That nails it down just right for me. I mean, okay, in this book I'm reading, he says...
What is this book?
Vincent D'Azadario, Theseus.
Podcast.
So you guys gotta read it. If you don't have this book, you gotta get it. he's being interviewed, but this chapter starts with a question from Vincent. You know him?
Yes.
Okay.
Love his
he
work.
Said, is authenticity possible now? That's the thing. The thing is it possible? Is it possible to do? And his interviewer says, of course. And Vincent says, with painted? And the interviewer says, yes, if it's possible to do with living, then it's possible to do it with painting. You just have to walk through more bullshit to get there.
Wait, the interviewer said that?
Yeah, you've hidden the real nature of the thing from yourself. But people live authentically all the time. If they can live authentically, I don't see... Painting's much less difficult than living. And I think in this moment, the interviewer has become the interviewee, and he's just really nailed that question. I mean, I don't need to read any more of the chapter.
Mm.
If you have an authentic experience and you know yourself,
yeah,
anything you say is valid, and you know it. You don't have to prove it to anyone. You just have to feel it. And I feel like, that's the theme. That's what we're talking about here. So you're trying to find out who you are with your paintings. And you're trying not to question whether it's authentic or not.
Yeah, it's like you don't want to, like, copy anybody else. You're not trying to, like, model yourself about anything. You're just trying to paint what's in your mind, no matter, like, good or bad you are.
Is that to you... I try to do a similar thing. Is that to you ever embarrassing? Is it... Does it feel silly at times or...
Vulnerable
or embarrassing, shameful? Does it feel self-indulgent? Does it feel...
I feel like it feels like all of those things. I mean, I'm not afraid to say that there are at least 5 to 10 paintings a year that I scrap that I'm ashamed to show the rest of the world because they're pretty bad. But... You know,
bad like, by whose measure? Just yours, right?
Sure. I mean, my husband will be really nice about it, but...
But what does he know?
No. Come on. Like, you know, like, I think there's an intuitive thing in the back of your mind that, you know, like, you look at something long enough and you're like, I fucked up. You know? Like, it's missing something. There's, yeah, it's not visually pleasing. There's something about it that... You know, of course.
But that's entertainment, in a way.
Yeah, but in a way, that's what makes an artist, is that you decide what goes in front of the rest of the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if it is not right with you, then that's your choice, you know? Mm-hmm. That's part of
your... Do you rely a lot on your intuition? Because, you know, mind versus intuition is like, those things are two separate things. Because the mind could just be looking at technical stuff, right? Like the shading, the drawing, so on and so on. But, you know, intuition is just like, okay, the feeling of it is like, is it working or not? And it's just like a simple thing. Like, if it's not, just like scrap the whole thing. Doesn't matter if the drawing is good or not. Right. Like,
I think my mind always thinks that I can do better, and I always know that I think that I will probably always think that way. So I've come to terms with that, but my intuition always tells me when to like destroy something.
Okay. So yeah, do you think you've ever satisfied that urge in your mind to do better?
No.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Oh. Interesting. Yes?
I know so we probably only have maybe 10 minutes left of this interview. We're going pretty long. But one thing that interests me about your work is that you use recurring symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
The fish head, the woman, the plants, the birds, a certain kind of light, a certain kind of detail. It becomes symbolic. It becomes your own iconography in a way. And I grew up in a church with iconography, where the Christ figure with a certain amount of, you know, clothes or of a certain color, they mean something about the story. I'm thinking, you know, if your work really is, if it is iconography, let's say it is iconography of a spiritual world of your own making, of an eternal truth that you're trying to find, what's the narrative? You know, what are the patterns? What does the fish head mean? What does the woman mean? What do those things mean?
It's hard to say. Like, I guess the figures are more of the metaphorical, and sculptural, and I don't know, like I feel like with the animals, it's kind of, you know, like you have these beautiful things, but they tend to be in sort of like, they're in a, I feel like they're in a slightly different plane than just like the females or the actual figures themselves. I do feel like I've caught myself several times realizing that my female figures, like from like maybe the knees down or something, like it's usually not a whole figure. And I think it's like this idea between fighting between like the earthly and this idea of something more transcendental in my work, and trying to marry between those two. Like I think we like to daydream of something metaphysical, but what is earthly really ties us here. You know, like we're only tied by our experience to our surroundings, but we can only like theorize about other worlds, other lives, other planets.
Oh my god, that makes so much sense in light of your work.
Put that in your bio.
No.
Yeah, so speaking of being around, you know, being grounded and whatnot, you recently moved away from New York. You're completely ungrounded right now. And where are you living right
That's
now?
That's projection tongue. That's a New York centric projection.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so tell us a little bit about that in 3 minutes. No. What is your experience with moving away from this, this mess that is New York?
I mean, I still love New York, but we moved to Pennsylvania, and I'm really happy with it. Like where we live, it rains like almost every other day. It's kind of like a rainforest on its own, yeah.
Weird.
And in the winter, it is so cold. Like the extremes are amazing, you know, because in the winter, like we had like 3 feet of snow.
Wow.
A lot of people lost power. Like, you know, like you feel like it's
and
wild.
The snow just stays around.
Yeah. No, yeah. It definitely stays around.
I saw that in Vermont. It's crazy. Yeah.
Like, it's very unpredictable. It's very, like, there's so much wildlife. Like, we went running the other day, and we're walking to the trail, and there's, like, 20 frogs, like, just jumping out of our way to, like, get out of
the way. JP must have loved that.
Oh, yes, exactly. Exactly. But he was like, oh, there's so many frogs. The environment is incredibly healthy. And I was like, yes, I love it here.
So just a little bit of
the machines are coming.
Backstory. You want to talk about your neighbors and your husband? Just so the listeners will know what we're talking about.
Oh, sure. Our friends that are neighbors?
Yeah, friends. Yeah, okay. That are neighbors.
So
yeah,
because
it's all a really small community.
Yeah, so we live in a little community, but our close artist friends that are neighbors are Adam Miller and Alexandra Pakula.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both incredible artists. Definitely look up for their work. but, you know, they're incredible support because they're, you know, yeah, it's just amazing to kind of have the interchange of people to kind of, you know, have this friendship with that are artists that understands the struggle, but, you know, also can explore the surroundings with you. And, you know, we always go to the beach and go swimming.
That's so cool.
Is it sort of, I envision that because I know those people, kind of hippie. Is it sort of a hippie life?
I don't, you know, they're not really hippie.
Bohemian?
Yeah. Alexandra is definitely bohemian. She probably won't admit it, but yeah, it's funny because she only paints cityscapes. She's so bohemian though. You wouldn't expect it at all.
Now I remember that studio in Bushwick that was very hippie where they all lived. Yeah,
her entire, like, their house is covered with hundreds of plants. I'm so envious of, like, she's got this green thumb that just...
Well, I got marigolds. I mean, look at these.
Marshall has four pots of plants in the entire apartment.
Wow, they're amazing.
They're really growing. Awesome, though.
Yeah. Literally. Like a week.
The beginning so of a long
satisfying.
Journey.
Yes. It's a long-term relationship.
No, it sounds like you landed in a nice place there.
Yeah, and how's your quality of life and your art making has been after the move? Do you feel that you have more headspace to explore your inner, you know, intuition and thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing the impact of your space that, you know, it kind of influences how you think about how you make your paintings, because the more space I have, mm-hmm. the more freedom I have in my paintings, the more crazier they get.
Mm.
And I don't know.
Like a kind goldfish.
Yeah, it's like we're like actually kind of looking at houses right now. Like, we need more space. But we'll see.
I'm trying to picture. I've never been to your place. Could you sort of let us visualize what we're working with
here? Into the nuts and bolts of what you're doing. Yeah. Your layout. What's your floor plan? Yes.
Just so, you know, I could like be the creeper outside. And you know,
I mean, we don't have like a big space, but we have, you know, like one of those open front, like huge windows in our home. And then we have, you know, a living room area that we've turned into like a big studio, and I've kind of like put a divider so I don't have to see my husband all the time.
Is that right? You have a divider between the two of you?
That's pretty healthy.
He's so hyper. He's so hyper.
What are these, like half walls, like little cubicle type things?
No, I made them out of canvas. So
that's awesome.
He fucking loves the chipmunks so much.
What do you mean the chipmunks? Like what are the chipmunks? Yeah.
Yes, so we have like hundreds
Elvin?
Of
chipmunks.
Elvin? Simon?
We literally have like hundreds of chipmunks outside because he's so obsessed with them. He fed them all winter to make sure none of them would die. And so now, every time he walks outside, they flood him. He can feed them out of his hand.
Oh, lordy.
He's like Dr. He's Google. Like,
or Snow White.
Yeah.
Snow White.
Yeah.
Even better.
Steve Irwin.
Steve Irwin.
But how did that go, though? That you just put like a, you know, it's like a sitcom, the line of tape between the room. This is my side, your side.
Yeah.
How did that go when you started erecting a barrier between him? See, like,
mine.
What's going on?
Give me peace of mind.
Do you
see
know
later.
JP?
Dude. I'll see you at lunch, honey.
So, yeah, like another backstory. So I went to, you know, school with JP. So
yeah,
we share studios. So I'm very familiar
with
putting up boundaries.
Yes, in the studio. You need boundaries. You do.
Yeah. Boundaries are very healthy.
I didn't know you were in a studio together.
Yeah, dude. We were first years, like, all the way through.
Really?
He's like, I know. Yeah. I know.
Oh, that's hilarious.
That's amazing.
I was married to him for 2 years.
Married.
At the academy.
We're peanut in this triangle here.
Oh, I mean, that's a whole nother story.
Well, Hannah, this has been a great interview.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
For coming out, leaving your chipmunks.
Leaving your compound, the chipmunks. JP's got one on his shoulder right now.
Probably. I mean, the reason we're doing this podcast is to make the art experience relatable.
Yeah.
In both the beautiful ways and the ugly ways. And I'm so glad you shared that with us today.
Yeah.
Thank you for your experience. It means a lot.
Thank you.
A plus.
Yay.
Thank you for listening to the Art Grime podcast. Rate and review us on Apple Podcast. Also, we're on Instagram at Art Grime Podcast. You can leave comments on the thread or DM us there. We usually see them. Also, Facebook, we're at Art Grime Podcast. You can leave comments, future questions for our guest and such there. Also, we're on, our website is www.artgrindpodcast.com.
Definitely go there for the beautiful images that we post. And don't be shy to donate some money so we could buy some really good booze for the guests.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.